You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Andy Baker has said her latest play, The Flick, in a rundown Massachusetts film theater with some dramatic results. It concerns the lives of three underpaid employees working in a cinema with one of the last 35-millimeter film projectors in the state. Annie Baker was here last to talk about her adaptation of Uncle Vanya, and before that, for her own Circle Mirror transformation, which was the second most produced play in America in the 2010-2011 season. I'm very pleased that she could come back this time with Matthew Mayer, who stars as Sam in this new production. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Happy Passover.
So, Annie, how far were you into working on The Flick when you were here to talk about Uncle Vanya?
I had finished The Flick, actually. I wrote The Flick, you know, I got the idea actually years ago and spent a really long time researching and ruminating about this play and finished a draft in 2011.
And so the working on Chekhov didn't affect your thinking about this play?
That's a good, you know, I think I've, you know, before working on Uncle Vanya in rehearsals, it's always been my favorite play. So I'm sure in some subliminal way, Uncle Vanya affected The Flick. But I actually did most of the draft of The Flick before translating Uncle Vanya.
A lot of the dialogue is about movie tastes and movie trivia. So which came first for you, a love of movies or theater?
Movies, actually. I grew up in a small town in western Massachusetts, and I was a total crazy movie buff. And my mom worked really long hours, so I would actually secretly rent movies and watch them before she got home from work, and then would hide them in my backpack and return them on my way back to school the next morning.
And what kinds of movies?
I was a snob. I was like,
one of your characters.
Yeah, the character of Avery in my play is described as a film snob. I was really into the French New Wave. I was pretty insufferable, but I kind of watched everything between the ages of 12 and 17, and I had total obsessive movie love.
Matthew, your character, Sam, makes fun of Avery. He says, well, you don't like anything that isn't in German with subtitles.
Right, exactly. I'm actually more, I think I am more like Sam in that regard. Actually, we're saying to somebody else that I came of age when I during like the golden age of the movie blockbuster. So I go to see movies, and I'm like, oh, you know, I saw my first movie was Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So my experience of watching movies is like take over my brain and thrill me, you know. So I never really got into art movies.
And well, I tried to convince Matt to watch Jules and Jim. Did you watch Jules and Jim and you were sort of unimpressed?
I did. I watched Jules and Jim.
You were unimpressed. Get out of here.
Yeah. I was like, this is
one of my favorite films.
I can't tell what's happening. I don't know what the big deal is.
Well, you're playing with that in the play as well. At one point, Sam defends current movies, and he says, well, Avatar was a great movie, and Avery says the equivalent of, please.
Yeah.
No way. Well, but Matthew, your credits are pretty much exclusively in theater.
Yes. Well, that's true. I mean,
And a lot of credits.
Yes, well, that's true. I've done some film work, but most of my work is in theater. I mean, I think it's like a grown-up. I guess I approach theater as more of an art form. I think it's hard for me to look at movies as anything but a consumer. You know, I think deeply about everything. But I mean, but as theater, as someone who spent most of their life doing it, I have more of a kind of a creative relationship to it than I do with movies.
Well, these days there has been more fluidity between film and theater than there was in the past. We pretty much every Broadway show has a film star in it. But here you're offering a different kind of tribute to a dying art form, real projected 35-millimeter film. What got you thinking about that?
Well, you know, talking about this fluidity between theater and film and how so many people who work in theater transition into film, you know, that was actually one of the things I wanted to talk about in the play, because to me, theater and film are such totally different art forms. I actually feel like theater, for me, writing plays is more like composing music or, you know, making an architectural blueprint than it is writing screenplays or making a movie, which I also do sometimes.
Well, there's the rhythm of the dialogue in the play.
There's the rhythm of the dialogue.
But you do the editing in the film. It's kind of musical as well, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I guess I feel like the big difference for me between theater and film that I wanted to sort of talk about in the flick is this issue of time. An event, actually. Like, I think theater is this, I just think the live event of theater actually resembles going to hear, for instance, live music much more than it does going to see a movie. You know, a movie, you're watching something that was shot, you know, months ago, years ago, a decade ago, and it's as, even if the movie, I love watching movies, but I think it's more, theater is a much more sort of immediate, scary, event-based art form.
So this play is very much about real time.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And that probably was the original idea. I'm going to do something where you really feel like this is happening at the moment, because theater
exactly.
can also be artificial, where everybody is talking very quickly.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And I feel like movies have influenced theater in the past 100 years in some beautiful, profound ways. And I also feel like movies have influenced theater in some negative, sort of sad ways.
So, Matthew, what does this mean, this real time, mean for an actor? Because there are often long pauses while people are thinking about things.
It means that you have to be extra rigorous and extra think extra deeply about what you're doing up there. I mean, if you have a long pause and where nothing's happening, you as an actor can't begin to think about your lunch, you know, what you're going to eat later.
You still have to stay in the moment.
Yeah, you have to cling more tightly to the moment than ever you would. It's actually talking, delivering a long speech, it's weirdly easier to go somewhere else because you're doing something. But in the middle of a silence, in order to make that silence something worth watching, you have to invest in the thoughts that your character is having.
Well, you can't do a lot of shtick because then that costs too much attention to you. At the
yeah.
same time, you have to look like you're really engaged in what's going on every second.
You can't be false.
So like, is this something you worked out in rehearsal?
Yeah, it's just something. In rehearsals, we're going very deep into the specifics. I mean, I should say, like, even though it's very naturalistic and there are lots of silences, everything was really, really rigorously choreographed. So even right down to the level of, in many of the long pauses, we would talk about what the characters were actually thinking about. And Sam, the director, would actually say, like, in this moment, I don't want you thinking about the future. I want you to think about the past. So
do
this moment, this minute long silent moment, and think about the past. And I would think about the past. And I would be doing nothing differently, but somehow my thinking about the past would be, he would say, like, oh, that's great. Do that instead.
So does the script say a minute pause?
Yeah, at one of the final stage stretchings of the play, Avery leaves, and then Sam stands there for a minute, you know, maybe a minute and a half, and then the final bit of dialogue, and then the play ends.
So how do you tell how long is right for a pause? And I ask you this as well, Annie.
I think when I write the script, I think a lot about it, and then I think a lot about it again in rehearsals. And our director, Sam Gold, is also has an incredible ear for timing, for the musicality of the play. And with this particular piece, we were also really lucky to work with three, and I'm not just saying this because Matt's sitting here, three really brilliant actors who each had their own kind of exquisite musical ear. So there's always a lot of debating in rehearsals, like, about how exactly the pause should go and how fraught it is and how relaxed it is, and we play around with it. I think some days pauses were longer and some days they were shorter, and also sort of depending on the night. It's really interesting reading the performance report for this play, because there can be a variance in 5 minutes in the length depending on night to night, based on just audience laughter and also just sort of on, like, the time of day and the mood you guys are in.
Yeah. Ironically, pauses get, the more emotionally felt the performances get, pauses get longer because you're like, oh, I'm having an emotion. And that's a danger sign. Sam Gold, the director, is often like, you're feeling too much your emotions. It's a finding a balance between you know, living a character on stage and but also moving things forward in a way that's real.
How have the audiences responded to this in the talkbacks? You've done a couple of talkbacks.
I have. Well, you know what's funny?
I don't mean this in particular, but that whole thing about real time.
Yeah. You know, we've had some really interesting audience response to this play. It's been a little bit, I don't know if polarizing is the right word, but there are some people who get very, very angry and some people who get very, very excited. And often it's like right down the middle in the audience. There's like some very angry people and some very ecstatic people sitting right next to each other.
Talking to each other
about
how they feel about the thing.
During the play.
Like oftentimes, it's not unusual for an audience member who I don't know be like, come up to me after the show and be like, I loved it so much I could have watched it for 3 hours more. The person I was sitting next to hated it so much, and they left an intermission, and we were talking, and I was like, wait, and they have a little, like, artistic debate, like, during intermission.
During intermission. Yeah, the funny thing is that because the play is over 3 hours long, a lot of the time the haters do leave during intermission, so they don't get to crucify me at the talkback.
It didn't happen when I was there, but okay. I guess when you're trying something different, some audiences buy into it, and other people won't buy into it, but usually that occurs with experimental theater. Do you think of this as experimental? Because it's on one level, it's probably the most realistic theater anybody could ever do without doing improv.
It's a really interesting question. I guess I hesitate to classify my work as either realist or experimental. Not that there's necessarily a clean difference between the two anyway, but I sort of like to think of myself as straddling both worlds. I mean, I think another reason that the audiences have been, or some sort of older, whiter, wealthier theater goers have been resisting the play, is that the whole play is movie theater ushers cleaning up after a show, and you are watching people clean up garbage for over 3 hours. And one woman at a talkback just said to me, I don't want to watch. I don't have to do that. She was like, I don't have to do that. I don't want to watch people do that for 3 hours. I want to, you know, I'm willing to watch someone sweep up garbage for a minute, and then I want to move on to something a little loftier. And
well,
I was
if
like,
they had
well,
been in an office and they were
you.
All typing, would that
right.
have been all
I think that
in
would
the
have
end?
Been a little more palatable to them. And that was something, the part of, I wanted to give the people who clean up garbage in movie theaters a 3 hour epic play.
But you also created three. Normally people talk about this kind of cast as an ensemble, and the three of you work very well together.
Yeah.
But the characters are three very different kind of person. And that's part of the one thing they have in common is they're all in a job that's beneath them.
Right.
And they're all kind of resentful on some level
right.
of working at a job that pays $8.50 an hour.
Yeah, yeah. And they're
especially
struggling.
Your character is 35 years old. The others are younger.
Yeah, yeah, they have the job. Avery has a job that one would have when one is 20 years old. But Sam, my character, does not has a job that one should never have at 35, or not should never have. But it's definitely a struggle.
He's stuck. A little stuck.
I'm talking with Annie stuck. Baker and Matthew Mayer about their play, the flick that is about three people working in a movie theater. Its run is through April 7th at the Playwrights Horizon on West 42nd Street. And for ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Now, Annie, I asked you a question earlier. We got sidetracked, but a part of the plot involves the conversion of movie theaters
right.
from 35-millimeter film
yes,
to
I
digital.
Yes, I evaded that question
Oh,
somehow.
You did? Okay.
No, because, I want to talk about it.
Because
I don't know
most
why
moviegoers probably aren't aware of the changes
yes.
from celluloid film to digital and don't see what will be lost.
Yes.
But one of your characters, Avery, sees the transition as a travesty,
yep.
a tragedy in the making. Is this kind of like the people who insist that vinyl is still the best way to hear a recording?
You know, I think it's a little different. I mean, it is about the transition from analog to digital, but I think one thing that I wanted to call attention to in the play is just the phenomenological difference between the two mediums, between film projection and digital projection and celluloid and digital movies. And I think what bothers me most about the transition from celluloid movies to digital movies is the fact that nobody's noticing. I think with the transition from vinyl to tapes to CDs to computers, like, everybody knew it was happening, and everyone was sort of talking about it.
And there are record stores that are popping up that sell vinyl.
And you know what you're buying when you buy it. But I think what's creepiest, actually, about the transition to digital film is the fact that a lot of audience members aren't noticing. Like, people go to see a movie, and sometimes I ask people afterwards, did you see it? Was it digitally projected, or was it a film projector? And they're like, I have no idea. For me, the difference is so clear. I kind of know the second I sit down. And that, I think, is actually that is the thing I find most bewildering, is that nobody's sort of just paying attention to and acknowledging the fact that this transition is happening.
Matthew, Annie mentioned earlier about the fact that some people objected to watching you clean up what we in the audience are watching, are looking where the screen would be.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're looking at a movie theater from the screen position. The aisles, the incline of the aisles, and you and Avery go through those aisles and clean up regularly through in each different little sequence. Was that choreographed?
Yeah, heavily choreographed. I mean, and that took a much of rehearsal of trying to figure out when we're sweeping in relation to the dialogue, how long we're sweeping, and how much popcorn needs to be placed in the aisle in between every scene so that we can sweep realistically but still get to aisle 3 in time for me to say this line.
So when we get a little blackout, somebody's running out there and throwing some popcorn on.
Not to reveal
theater magic, but there are hoses attached to along the wall that blow shellacked popcorn out onto the floor.
So you can use
between
it every night.
So we can use it every night, and it can attract rodents.
So it is a dance piece. I think of the play as a dance piece, and Sam Gold and I knew going in that it was a dance piece. And so that's why I'm always surprised when people talk about all the pauses and silences. I mean, I know they're in there, but for me it's sort of like a dance piece with dialogue.
Yeah. Would these people even be in contact with each other if it were not for these jobs?
No, they wouldn't. And that's funny.
Because part of the dance is moving tentatively toward some kind of a relationship that they would never have had otherwise.
Nicholas, who one of his jobs is an usher at the Angelica, right?
Oh, yes, one of our consultants.
One of our consultants. He made a really good point to me after he saw the show, is that, like, you have an intimate relationship with people who you only talk to at, like, 10-minute intervals, like, 6 times a day. Like, you're seeing, basically, it is an intimacy that the characters have that's, like, but the other people, they don't know each other very well. And I think a lot of the undercurrents of the play is this sort of feeling of these characters feel like they know each other, but in fact they don't know each other at all.
And in the end, they wind up all betraying each other.
Yeah.
There are lots of little betrayals. I had so many weird day jobs for years, and there is this kind of emotional intimacy that develops that is so particular, and then you leave the job or the job ends and you never see these people again, but they're I feel like they're a huge part of your consciousness sort of for the rest of your life.
Yeah. But what about working in the theater? Because you worked with your director Sam Gold before, and you've worked with Matthew before.
Yes.
In fact, did you have him in mind?
I wrote the part for Matt, and I actually saw him in a play back in 2003 when I had just graduated from college, and I became determined to write a play for him because I really think he's like one of the great stage actors of our time. And I actually told him before we went into rehearsals that if he quit the play, I would die. I mean, I used some like really dramatic language because I really don't know how I would and Sam would have ever done the play without him. And the other two actors who we actually found through auditions but weirdly feel as perfectly suited for their characters as Matt does.
Now, the earlier play, Circle Mirror, I gather, changed a lot during rehearsals.
We had a lot of development, actually, sort of before we went into rehearsals for Circle Mirror. We sort of went off to the Sundance Theater Lab and made a lot of changes there. But I don't make a ton of changes in rehearsals to everyone's dismay.
Not dismay. I would describe it. It's just there's very, very little rewriting on either Uncle Vanya. I mean, what are you going to rewrite with Uncle Vanya, I guess? Someone else already wrote it. But
Uncle Vanya gets the girl at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but on the flick, very the least, I would say, ever. But not
the likes. There were lots of jokes about how one day I would put in a like and then take out the like the next day.
Yeah. Sometimes we talk about trimming pauses, because pauses are often talked about and dealt with as though they are dialogue. So you take a pause in, out, put it back in, go through the changes. And
the likes, seismic. And the likes are important because we're also talking about people of a couple of generations working together, and they talk differently.
From different class backgrounds, too. I think the way Sam Matt's character speaks and the way Avery speaks is very different. One of them is highly educated and from an educated family, and Matt's character is from a more working class background.
Yeah. You also play throughout the production music from the ends of movies. That must have been a lot of fun.
Well, so our director, Sam Gold, had this great idea that makes me so happy, and nobody actually realizes it, or maybe a couple of people have when they watch the play, but all of the end of the movie at the beginning of the play is actually, I wrote into the script, it's the prelude to... it's Bernard Herrmann's Prelude to Naked and the Dead. But then the rest of the ends of movies throughout the play are the ends of actual movies that were playing in the summer of 2012 when the play takes place. So they're actually like real cheeseball movie endings from the summer.
Yeah, like Madagascar 3.
That played in little small town theaters. And people don't know that, but it was such a great idea on Sam's part. And a great sound designer, Bray Poore, found this amazing music.
Yeah. Yeah, the amount of the attention to detail on this play is like enormous. It's more greater than I've encountered before. Everything that the audience would never notice was thought through with immense detail.
You just won the international award, the Susan Smith Blackburn Prize, Annie.
Yeah.
And then got a 4-week residency starting in May at Horton Foote's Preserve Home.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about that. I weirdly have written my past 2 plays in Texas, and was starting to ask myself if I can only write plays in Texas. And then I got this call that I was allowed to live in Horton Foote's house for a month in Texas in May. So hopefully my next play will come from that.
And is it important to you the setting in which you write a play?
You know, what's so strange is it must totally influence the play, but you never know exactly how it will influence the play, and I'm not sure why I find the state of Texas so conducive to writing.
Well, Horton Foote has to be somebody who you feel some kinship to.
Oh, yeah, and I can't believe I get to sit in his study and write at his desk. It's this huge honor. It's going to be really fun.
Well, Matt, before you leave, let me request that you give Jules and Jim another chance.
Oh, yes, I will. I'll give it a good... I feel like I owe Jules and Jim a great deal.
I feel like I just sold you out is what I feel.
And you're teaching these days as well.
Yes.
So is that... You studied with the wonderful playwright Mack Wellman.
Yes.
Do you teach similarly to him?
He has been a huge inspiration to me as a teacher. I don't know if I teach in quite the same way, and I teach at a very different institution. I teach at NYU and at SUNY Stony Brook. But I definitely, Mack really encourages his playwriting students to be iconoclastic and to really develop their own voice and not just write aspirationally or imitatively. Mm-hmm. Did I say that right?
Yes.
And that was a huge lesson I learned from him, and I try to incorporate that into my teaching.
Annie Baker's latest play is The Flick. It's at the Playwrights Horizon, 416 West 42nd Street, and runs till April 7th. And then something else has to come in?
Something else has to come in.
And Matthew Mayer plays Sam, the older of the three main characters. There is a fourth character, but he has a very minor part. And I thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having us.